I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 6th of July. Hope your July 4 weekend was absolutely splendid. This hour, it's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 1. And Keith Boykin is our guest this hour. He's a New York Times bestselling author, TV commentator, and educator. His latest book is For Colored Boys Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Still Not Enough, which won the American Library Association Stonewall Award for Nonfiction in 2013. He attended law school with President Barack Obama, served in the White House as a special assistant to President Bill Clinton, helped organize the nation's first ever meeting between a sitting president and leaders of the LGBT community. He has starred on the Showtime series American Candidate. He was co-host of BET series My Two Cents. He's currently a CNBC contributor, MSNBC commentator, and BET columnist, and founder and first board president of the National Black Justice Coalition. He is a very busy person. We're going to be talking about South Carolina. He's covered race, a great number of writings about race, and of course today they are debating what to do about the Confederate flag in South Carolina. So we will look at that. We will look at the dark part of our nation's history, one of the dark parts of our nation's history. We'll also be looking at what he calls these historic times, the flags that have come down over southern capitals, health care reform affirmed by the Supreme Court, and also the right of gay and lesbian couples to marry in any state of the Union. The New York Times had an interesting piece yesterday, though, saying even though liberal victories may have been happening, there are some questions as to whether or not some of these cases should even have made their way to the Supreme Court. I know that many of you will want to talk about the open records issue here in the state of Wisconsin Thursday night, an attempt to get rid of the state's open records law. One newspaper, the Lakeland Times, called it a political calamity for the Republicans. They have said that they will not put this in the budget and it will be discussed further. The governor has said that we'll talk about this issue with the caveat that Keith is not from Wisconsin. But I do know that you want to express your opinion, so feel free to do that. We don't expect him to be up on all of the issues that are going on in the state of Wisconsin. For you to join us, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
Let's start with South Carolina, where they are debating today what they're going to do about the Confederate flag issue. I guess there's been some nasty rhetoric in South Carolina, but it is amazing, as you write, after so many years of horrible racism and flying that flag, which really stood for a Confederacy, for this issue to finally be debated in South Carolina and in other places is a little sign of progress, wouldn't you say?
I would. It's definitely a sign of progress, and I like the qualifier little
right
that you used. I think I'm glad that Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, came out and supported the change of the state for the flag to be removed from the state capitol grounds, and Republicans have come along as well, as many Democrats. I do think that this is such a belated conversation, though. The Civil War ended 150 years ago, and there are people in our country who are still flying a treasonous flag that represents a war against our nation and the support of the institution of slavery. The idea that this was ever acceptable is just kind of shocking, and that we're now having this debate, and that there has to be a debate about this is still a little bit upsetting.
Well, what you hear, of course, you know, from the other side is this is part of our cultural heritage.
Yeah, I've heard that argument before. And it's a hard argument to make when the flags, for the most part, did not fly over most southern capitals for many, many years after the Civil War, that they were reintroduced in most instances in the era of the Civil Rights Movement. as an effort to rebuff those who were fighting for equal rights and integration in the South. So the idea that somehow this has been, the flag itself has been a part of their heritage, it just doesn't seem to be supported by the evidence itself. But even if it were, it still represents traitorous, treasonous, slavery-owning and supporting members of our nation who defied our country and cost us many hundreds of thousands of lives in a bloody war.
When you wrote so movingly about what happened in Charleston, South Carolina, you said that the tragedy is that racism in 2015 is still being defined and discussed in isolated and limited incidents instead of acknowledged as the ubiquitous problem that it remains. Tell me more about that. How do we discuss it in isolation? How should we be discussing this issue?
Well, I think, for example, when we saw the shooting with in Charleston, Dylan Roof, there was a tendency in that case to assume mass murders are relatively rare in this country, but to assume that this was something that was so outrageous, so extreme, and so extraordinary that it could only be considered in the context of one deranged young man, as opposed to the fact that this was a man who was the product of, the byproduct of, a racially biased system and structure that enabled him to continue to think the way he did and to continue to act on his thoughts in the way that he did. And for the most part, continues to encourage others as well. As long as we have Confederate flags flying on pickup trucks throughout the South and state capitals and other places where they are glorified and held to some sort of a level of esteem, I think it sends a message that black lives do not matter. And that has been the whole focus of the effort from the campaign of the people who have been fighting against the police violence incidents over the course of the past year, to emphasize that black lives should matter, that we have to look at this from a holistic point of view. Now, whenever you hear a story about a Trayvon Martin or an Eric Garner in New York or a Tamir Rice in Cleveland or a Michael Brown in Ferguson, that we shouldn't think that this is just a rare incident, that these incidents are happening over and over again throughout our country. And there, and the sad part about it with regard to the police violence is that there are no laws in the federal level that require the police to keep records of these things.
Mm-hmm. What was it about the Charleston event? Was it the response from the community? Was it the horror of this happening in church? Was it seeing those beautiful faces over and over, state lawmakers and librarians and teachers, just sort of the heart of America gunned down in a church? Was it so horrific that that's what made Nikki Haley say what she was going to say? It's what made Confederate flags come down? Why? Why was that the response?
You know, I don't know why that was the response from Nikki Haley. I can't really figure that out. But I think it was partly because of the pressure that that faced her and other other leaders and legislators in the state. I think it was the idea that this young man, Dylan Roof, had wrapped himself literally and figuratively in the Confederate flag.
Yes.
Posted photos of himself with it and actually burning the American flag. And I think that there are two photos on his website, one where he's holding up the Confederate flag and another where he's burning the American flag. When you put those images side by side, you see what the Confederate flag actually represents. It represents, even though people may not want to admit it, it represents a traitorous, treasonous fight against the United States of America. And I think it was really hard for anybody to defend that flag anymore after they saw those images. It was the part that it was nine lives were taken, that there were African Americans in a church who were peaceful as they were being shot and killed.
Mm-hmm.
It was also just the idea that this is something that has been long overdue, and people have been complaining about this for decades, including in South Carolina, where they tried to resolve it once before, but nothing had happened.
The other, it has been an extraordinary month when you think about it, or the end of last month was. You wrote an interesting piece about how black America helped win marriage equality, and you referenced 12 years ago when you stood at a podium in Washington, D.C. and announced with colleagues support for marriage equality and the formation of a new organization called the National Black Justice Coalition. What was that coalition, and did people, and were you thinking that here is an issue that really must be front and center for the LGBT community, or were you a reluctant joiner because you thought other issues might be more pressing?
Yeah, that's a good point. I was a reluctant joiner to the issue. I thought it was an important issue, just not the most important issue facing the LGBT community. I still believe that, although I think that the Supreme Court decision was tremendously important, historic, and significant for the community. I think at the time, what we were doing when we created the coalition is that we were responding to a specific set of African-American pastors in Massachusetts and in other states after Massachusetts became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage. An awful lot of black pastors came out and started condemning this institution, the idea of same-sex marriage, as though they were speaking for all black people. And I thought that was troubling because I think that there is a tendency to assume that African-Americans are monolithic in our thinking and to assume that we are more homophobic than others. And I wanted to be a part of a group of people to challenge that thinking. So we wanted to respond to that narrative by creating this organization that would help fight for marriage equality as well as against racism and homophobia. And it's important to make those connections, to draw those links. So that's the reason why we came together for that purpose with that group. At that time, I don't think anyone else there expected that we would be at this point 12 years later. I thought it would take some decades before we got to this point.
Mm-hmm.
But the movement has just grown so rapidly, and especially in the years since the Obama administration came into office, with the support of the president most recently. So I think that's made a tremendous difference, having leadership from the top. As well as, of course, the people coming out all across the country and people leading on their own in their own communities at the state level and local level and the grassroots level.
So now is the focus more on bread and butter economic and social justice issues, jobs, health care, access to education, housing discrimination, mass incarceration?
I'm not sure that it is. I would hope that it would turn to those issues, but I'm not sure that it will. There has been some positive developments from people in the LGBT community who came out last week and said very clearly, leadership from various organizations, that now we have to focus on other issues like employment discrimination and housing discrimination, two very important issues that affect LGBT people, and a lot LGBT people of color as well. And so it'll be interesting to see where that goes. There's an Employment Non-Discrimination Act that has been put forward in Congress for decades now, and it's never been passed, obviously, and it's unlikely to be passed in the current Republican Congress, but maybe there can be some new momentum on this to get at least a vote on record. But I think what we're seeing now with the shift in consensus on the marriage equality issue is that it's kind of forcing Republicans to defend a position that's becoming increasingly unpopular with the public. And to do so, to put the Republicans on the defensive, I think it may encourage some Republicans to come off the fence a bit and to start to articulate more nuanced positions or even more supportive positions on LGBT equality issues and LGBT civil rights issues.
We certainly haven't heard that from any of the Republican candidates when it comes to their response to the Supreme Court decision, have we?
No, we haven't. Not a single one of the candidates responded in a positive way. But there was some distinction in how they responded, too. This is an interesting point about your Governor Scott Walker. The three, I think, most likely candidates to win the nomination, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Scott Walker, based on the polls right now, were the ones who I expected to respond with a somewhat moderate position along the lines of, well, the Supreme Court has made its decision now, we have to accept the rule of law and move on, and we can express our opinions in other ways, which is sort of what Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush did. But Scott Walker did not, and it shocked me, actually. He took a much more hard right position on this and called for a constitutional amendment, as you know, and I think that that's a politically untenable position in the general election. Were he to win the nomination for the Republican Party for the presidency, I think that position would come back to haunt him. And I understand that he is apparently doing this in an effort to win the nomination, particularly to win Iowa, where they have a much more conservative evangelical base of supporters who turn out for the caucuses. But I am increasingly convinced that that position will not work well in the general election at all.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Keith Boykin is our guest. He also, I want to ask him about, it's interesting history. It wasn't all that long ago, but he did organize, as I said in the intro, the nation's first ever meeting between a sitting president, and that was Bill Clinton. He was working in the White House with the Clinton administration and leaders of the LGBT community. And I wonder what was said, why it was organized. And so we can look at recent history and what's happened since then. It's actually fairly remarkable. We're going to welcome phone calls. Keith, of course, as I said, is not from Wisconsin, but there has been a lot of news over the weekend about this open records law. The Lakeland Times, a fairly conservative paper here in Wisconsin, wrote this was before the Republicans made the announcement that they were going to withdraw this part of the budget bill that looked at open records. But they had a pretty scathing editorial. As it stands, the Thursday night pre-holiday attempt to eviscerate the state's open records law is a potential calamity for the Republicans. There's no way this outrage won't damage the GOP brand, but unless it's pulled from the budget, it will become a political travesty that will do far more harm to the very foundation of democracy. They say it is nothing less than the attempted murder of honest government, and the perpetrators of it deserve the political equivalent of the death sentence. They say that the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee need to come clean and tell the world who authored this attack on democratic principles. If they won't, they go on to say they need to be recalled. So without expecting Keith to know all the details of this, I know that you want a chance to respond to that. And let's respond to what's going on in South Carolina with discussions today about the Confederate flag, about still, we hate to move into new territory right away. There should be time to reflect more on the Supreme Court decisions regarding affordable care and regarding same-sex marriage in this country. The New York Times had an interesting piece yesterday, 10 years of an activist court, and looked at what is the most useful way to understand the direction of the Supreme Court 10 years into the tenure of Chief Justice John Roberts. After some cases that mostly came out the way liberals wanted, it's tempting, they write, to see a leftward shift among the justices, but then they go on to say that would be a mistake. So we'll welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter, @KDunnShow. And Keith Boykin is our guest, a New York Times bestselling author, TV commentator, public speaker, actor, educator, lawyer, former member of the Clinton White House, went to law school with President Barack Obama. And we'll be with you in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All things political this hour, 800-486-8655. Our number, Ken Boykin, is our guest, and we'll start our calls with John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hi there.
Hi.
I wanted to just report an interesting experience. Way back in the day, we were making a very long march from Selma to Montgomery. And the president had nationalized the Alabama National Guard to protect us. Unfortunately, they were all wearing Confederate flags on their uniform.
Mm.
We got to the state capitol, and Dr. King was speaking to us. And at the very top of the state capitol was a flagpole flying the Confederate flag. The only American flag was on a short flagpole out in the parking lot. Mm. And I've been thinking about it ever since.
Do you think that we isolate it, that we're not talking about race as fully as we should, as Keith has
said? It's easy to make the flag a scapegoat. It's certainly a powerful symbol, but it's simply a symbol. The real issues are the continuing, ongoing, sometimes violent prejudice.
Keith.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think That story about the Confederate flag is actually very insightful, first of all. And I do believe it's just a symbol of a larger problem. But it strikes me as odd that we have in this country people who are calling themselves pro-American, in many cases ultra-conservative, pro-American, who defend a Confederate flag which represents treason against America, mm-hmm. and refuse to follow the orders of the nation's highest court. And this doesn't strike me as being very pro-American, but this is the America that we live in today, and I think it's important that we don't let this continue without resisting or challenging that narrative, the Southern heritage narrative or the Southern pride narrative about the Confederate flag. But even beyond that, you know, as the caller was saying, just understanding the ways in which the structural impediments that affect African-American society or African-American life or any people of color today still have enormous impact on our society. If you look at the jobs market, for example, the unemployment rate for African Americans that came out just a few days ago was 9.5%. It's still much lower than it was a few years ago at 16.8%, but it's twice the rate almost of the white population for unemployment. Healthcare disparities continue to exist. Educational disparities, access to housing, incarceration rates, all these different issues that we've never really resolved that reflect the systemic racial biases of white supremacy that haven't gone challenged and won't be challenged if we just simply take down a flag and think we've done our job.
Thank you so much, John, for your call. Paul writes on Facebook, I think removing the Confederate flag is important, but being lost in this discussion is what to do about the actual problem of racism and police terror in our country. Taking down the flag will not do anything to change our biased social structure. In fact, it may even further racial tensions and white hostility as they resist the modification of what they see as their cultural heritage. The roots of racism must be dealt with.
Agreed, but we should still take down the flag.
And what about this resistance, too? Is there to be an anticipated, we've already seen stirrings of it, backlash, a resurgence of this Southern pride, I stand behind the flag, or a resurgence in, I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. When you have these big issues, does it make people mad who really adhere to a different philosophy or a different culture? And it will stir things up for some time to come, Keith.
Yeah, there's always backlash whenever there's any sort of progress. But I actually think that the backlash we're seeing is actually potentially very useful. Useful because every time I turn on CNN and I see some old white Southern guy defending the Confederate flag, it kind of makes the argument why the Confederate flag is not exactly the most inclusive device or symbol for African Americans. Telling black people they shouldn't be offended having an old white guy from the South say that just doesn't really resonate with the public. And I think that those messengers communicating that message is horrible for the Confederate flag brand, the conservative brand, and the Republican Party, which has for a long time defended that, or at least coddled it. And similarly with the issue of marriage equality, when you see the people who are opposing it, sometimes literally or rather figuratively, standing at the doorway trying to prevent progress, in a sort of George Wallace style. We see this in places like Alabama and Texas, where judges and attorneys general and others have sworn not to abide by the law until they were forced to do so. I don't think that's a good representation for the Republican Party. I don't think that's a good representation for any modern political party because it brings back those images of the segregationists who fought against the civil rights era in the 1950s and 1960s, the Bull Connors, you know, mm-hmm. in Alabama, and the George Wallaces. And those images won't help any political party trying to grow itself into the 21st century.
Mm. I don't know if you saw yesterday's editorial in the New York Times. It was an interesting one, attempting to look at what they have learned from 10 years of the tenure of Chief Justice John Roberts. A lot of people were seeing this as liberal victories, these cases that came down, and they said that the recent decisions on same-sex marriage, discrimination in housing, the Affordable Care Act, and others seem more like exceptions, they say, than anything else. It's not a trend toward growing liberalism, but rather the failure of hardline conservative activists trying to win in court what they have failed to achieve through legislation. Would you agree with that, that it's not really liberal victories? And they make a case in point with the ACA, which they say it never should have gone to the Supreme Court. It was an intentional misreading of four words.
I'm not sure if I agree with the New York Times analysis, although I understand the point that you can't necessarily take a few Supreme Court cases, the Affordable Care Act, the marriage equality decision, for example, and extrapolate from that that the court has moved to the left on a permanent basis. Although I understand this is perhaps the most liberal term of the Supreme Court in more than a decade or two, I do think that what we are seeing is, and this may be the part that the Times is trying to make as well, that the liberals, at least on the Supreme Court, have been better organized in making and building coalitions to win their arguments, to win their cases, than the Republicans are. The Republicans have been fractured. When I say liberals and Republicans, I actually mean those who are appointed by Democratic appointees, Democratic presidents, or Republican presidents. But I think that the Republican appointees have been more fractured, the conservatives on the court. And they have often written opinions that were concurring opinions, dissenting opinions that didn't speak with one voice. Whereas on the liberal side, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has sort of formed a coalition of the four liberals, and they've worked together to pull off a John Roberts here or an Anthony Kennedy here to win those important decisions. They don't win all the decisions. They lost a couple of big cases just last week as well. One, for example, on the Environmental Protection Agency's
yes.
ability to regulate. But when they can speak, they speak, and they try to speak with one voice, which I think helps the liberal cause as well.
I wanted to ask you before we go back to phone calls, I'm just interested in this meeting that you organized with leaders of the LGBT community, and I guess President Clinton, right? When was that? What was talked about?
Yeah, that was in April of 1993. That was the first time that any president had ever met with leaders of the LGBT community. And it was surprising to say today, it was somewhat risky for the president to do, even though Bill Clinton had spoken out in favor of lifting the ban on gays in the military, in favor of the Employment Non-Discrimination Bill. Just the idea of meeting with gay people was taboo for a president of the United States. But we put together the meeting. We met in the Oval Office. There were about, I think, seven or eight leaders from the LGBT community who came that day. And they tried to impress upon the president that the issues that affected the LGBT community were issues that should concern any president, that these weren't issues that should be taboo. But there was still a great deal of controversy about putting together. I remember we scheduled the meeting on a Friday afternoon. We didn't really do a big press release or announcement about it. There wasn't a great deal of attention about it. That was a purposeful move on the part of the White House, not my suggestion, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But on the part of the White House, sort of downplay it so it wouldn't become a big controversy. And there was an interesting moment in the meeting that I recall. One of the members of the group there asked the president what he thought he would be remembered for in history. And he mentioned two things. One, for lifting the ban on gays in the military. And two, for health care reform.
Oh, my goodness.
It turns out he did neither one of those.
That's fascinating. Let's go to more phone calls. Willem in Colfax is next. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I agree with the guest's comments about the Confederate flag. It represents treason against, the United States of America. But anyway, that's not why I called. I called because of he was seen shocked by Scott Walker's statement about gay marriage. And to us who live in Wisconsin, I think this is often lost on the national press, is that Scott Walker has a long history of making convenient statements I don't know. I guess when I was growing up, we used to call them lies, but now they pass as, you know, political savviness or whatever. But he's, I think the people who don't live in Wisconsin or haven't experienced the full force of Scott Walker's ideology don't really understand what he represents. Like, you know, attacks. He's very divisive, like that Southern issue. He divides working people in his perception, you know, and I think in his rhetoric, you know, hard-working taxpayers against those college elites and those spoiled teachers who need to work harder, you know, and all the statements that he said. I think he's one of the most divisive governors in the history of our state, and I'm 64 years old, so I've seen a lot of governors, and nothing ever like Scott Walker.
Keith, you think you said that he's probably, well, he's running first, I think, still in Iowa, but I think you said that he is among the three who have the best chance of securing the nomination.
Yeah, he's a top-tier candidate, you would say, in the Republican Party to win the nomination, along with Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush. And, yes, I was shocked, and I don't know Scott Walker as well as people from Wisconsin do, obviously. But what shocked me wasn't so much about his history of being divisive. I knew about that. What shocked me is that he's still doing that at this point in his campaign, that he's so desperate to win. And I guess he hasn't really, you know, formally had a campaign to speak of, but he's so desperate, apparently, to win in Iowa and to win conservative voters that he's willing to take a position that makes him somewhat unelectable in the general election. That's what I'm surprised at, because prior to that statement on the constitutional amendment against same-sex marriage, I had thought that Scott Walker was trying to position himself for to be a serious candidate, a serious general election candidate, but it clearly does not appear to be the case. And I don't know how he's going to make that transition if he were to win the nomination. I think that's going to be a very, very difficult transition. One more point about this. It's important to understand that it's not because the majority of the public supports marriage equality that he has to worry about this. But even the independent voters who are not necessarily affiliated with either party, those are the ones he has to worry about, because your position on an issue like marriage equality or immigration or even something like the Confederate flag is an indicator of what type of leader you will be, what type of president you will be, of where your views are, whether you're an open and tolerant person. And his expression of ideas makes him look like a backward candidate, like an old-fashioned Republican and not a current Republican. And I don't think that's going to help at all.
Well, today, I don't know where this story came from, and I don't know if it softens him as a candidate, but today it was reported in the Huffington Post and other places that his sons are mad at him for his stance on same-sex marriage. And he was quoted as saying, well, families have, differences of opinions, and I explain to them why I think the way I do, and I listen to them to think the way they do, and that's what it's all about. We could disagree civilly, etc. Does that soften his image? It almost seems planted in a way to me, but
maybe it's the same thing.
Do you think so? So I wasn't the only one to think that.
It's a strategically planted story. If I were the campaign manager in that position, I would try to plant a story like that to try to show that there is at least some possibility that he might be open-minded, you know, that type of thing. But it doesn't really matter what the family thinks. What matters is what the candidate thinks. And the candidate has made it very clear that he is not living in the 21st century in terms of the issue of marriage equality. The majority of Americans disagree with him on that issue. And people won't vote solely on one issue, but again, it's the accumulation of different positions on issues that make you look like you're not a candidate of the future that will be troubling for him. Now, remember, the Republicans are running against Hillary Clinton, more than likely, assuming she went to nomination, who will be a somewhat older candidate than past Democratic nominees, definitely older than Barack Obama. And they want to position her as a candidate of the past. But they can't do that as long as they stay wedded to positions about the past with the immigration reform, with the Confederate flag, or with health care reform, and definitely with marriage equality. You can't be a party of the 21st century when you're still trying to drag America back to the 20th century.
Do the Republicans need to fashion their own health care plan for the general election, do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think if they wanted to do that, I think the time to do that was in 2010 when the Affordable Care Act was passed, or maybe during one of the 50 or so times when they tried to repeal or replace Obamacare, I guess just repeal in the past 5 years. But if they haven't come up with a plan now, I doubt that anyone will seriously take what they say in the future as sort of gospel. And there is a great deal of division within the Republican Party about this as well. Most Republican governors, of course, don't want to and have not taken Medicaid expansion from the Affordable Care Act. And a lot of Republican governors are benefiting from the Affordable Care Act in their states, even though they haven't supported it in any way. So, you know, when the Supreme Court issued decisions, I'm sure you and your listeners already know, that was actually a godsend for the Republican Party as well, because they don't have to be in the position of coming up with an alternative to help those people who lose their health insurance as a result of what could have been a devastating decision from the court.
Mm-hmm. It would have been. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine if it had gone the other way, what we might be talking about today?
That's all we would be talking about. You can think of the people who lose their health insurance because of the Supreme Court and because Republicans advocated for this over a technicality. And Democrats were already ready with the bill, a one-line bill, to amend the law to fix it. And would Republicans go along with that? And I think that would be horrible optics and horrible politics for the GOP.
Willem, thanks for your call. Mary in Madison, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment on the open records controversy at the state capitol, and I really don't think that the legislature had any intention of passing that law. I think this is all a carefully scripted play so that Scott Walker can say that he stood up for open records in Wisconsin. I don't believe that the legislature has that much independent thought anymore. After all the misery that Governor Walker has visited on this state, I think he's pretty firmly in control. So that's my comment.
Do you think, Mary, before you go, that it's important to find out whose idea it was?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, whoever is, you know, holding that dirty bag of laundry should pay for it. But it's just on direction from him and the Koch brothers.
Thanks, Mary, for your call. Elaine in Appleton, hi.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
The thing that was never brought up with this Confederate flag was there were 650,000 American citizens killed in the Civil War, both North and South. I have no idea how many of these men went home with missing an arm or a leg in the war. And they were hit with these big lead bullets the size of a tennis ball. And they had their limbs crushed, and there was the only way they could do is to amputate in those days. And there were a lot of widows because of the Confederates. And also, not one of the Confederate government officials were ever sentenced for treason.
Keith.
She makes a good point. The point is that this was a war that was settled 150 years ago. It was a bloody war, one of America's bloodiest wars, in fact. And here we are still debating whether it's acceptable for the most pervasive symbol of that war to still be flown in capitals in the United States of America. The idea that the German government would allow a Nazi swastika to be flown anywhere in public property is astounding to anyone. It's so inconceivable, and yet we allow a flag that represents not only treason but slavery to be flown in various states and all across this union. I just think it's overdue, long overdue, and a reflection of the undercurrent of racial animus that still exists in our country.
It's not just the flag, though. You look at all the statues of Confederate generals, and I wonder how many statues of Abraham Lincoln are in the South. I really do wonder that.
Well, you know, they have statues of of Confederate and secessionist and segregationist leaders on the South Carolina Statehouse grounds. In fact, a reporter did a survey of all the statues and monuments on the Statehouse grounds, and they found that there's only one African American represented in the entire Statehouse grounds, and that was the illegitimate daughter of Senator Strom Thurmond.
More phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political you're listening to. We haven't talked about Greece yet. Greece voted no. You probably know this. 61% to 39% yes. I don't know what the ramifications will be of that, but we'll ask Keith to tell us what he thinks. And we'll welcome your phone calls. Any topics we've already discussed that you'd like to discuss yourself, feel free to do that or move us into other territory. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to welcome more phone calls now for Keith Boykin. Keith is, he's got so many talents. You know, his resume is really long, but he's a New York Times bestselling author. Each of his four books has been nominated for a Lambda Literary Award. His recent book, most recent, is For Colored Boys Who've Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Still Not Enough. It won the American Library Association's Stonewall Award for Nonfiction in 2013. He went to Dartmouth and Harvard, attended law school with President Barack Obama, served in the White House as a special assistant to President Bill Clinton, and he is currently an CNBC contributor, MSNBC commentator, and BET columnist, and also the former editor of The Daily Voice. Okay, let's go to more phone calls. And thank you, Elaine, for your call. George in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. I want to ask you whether or not in this day and age America will elect a president that doesn't have a college degree. And I wouldn't want my kids respecting someone in the White House that doesn't have a college degree. What do you think?
Good question. At this point, I think it's very difficult, not impossible, for someone to be elected without a college degree. But we do have examples of people who have been enormously successful who don't have college degrees, people like Mark Zuckerberg, for example, who dropped out of college to start Facebook. And I think It would probably be a reflection of what other accomplishments the person had achieved in her or his life that would determine whether she or he could succeed in that capacity. I don't think it's impossible. I'm sure if you go back in history, there's probably some example before I'm not aware of, but I don't think it's impossible at all.
I think Harry Truman was the last, wasn't he?
I can't remember. I'm not sure. I know he was a haberdasher. That's the thing I remember.
Yeah.
And he's from Missouri.
Yeah. We need to talk about Greece for a moment. Voting no. Do you know what the ramifications of this will be? I know that the stock market and everything went into this turmoil last week as a result of the uncertainty. Now with the vote, does it throw the European Union, the euro, topsy-turvy and has ramifications for our markets? Do you have a comment on it, Keith?
Well, I heard earlier today, right before the show went on, that the European Central Bank decided to leave emergency funding open for Greek banks. And that was something that had been a concern, whether the vote would have ramifications with the ECB. I think there is a great deal of turmoil in Greece because they have felt the pain of austerity for so long. I would be surprised if they would have voted to continue along those lines. And I think what we're seeing in Greece and Spain and to a certain extent in other countries in Europe is the failure of austerity as a measure to fight the type of recession that we just experienced, a global recession. And we tried it here in this country for a few years. There was an effort to push for austerity with the new Republican Congress that came in during the Obama administration. And the president at some point seemed to want to go along and try to compromise and then decided not to, which I think was the best move. But by investing in our country, in whatever country it may be, in Greece or the U.S., I think we actually become more productive. People like Paul Krugman and others, New York Times economists, have written about the failure of austerity, and I just think it's sad that we continue to try the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And I don't think that punishing Greece is going to be the solution. I think we have to come up with a solution. The world has to develop a solution that allows Greece to to pay back its debt, but not to not to impose onerous constraints on it so that it can't grow.
Thanks, George, for your call. Let's go next to KC in Minocqua. Hi, KC.
Good afternoon. First off, it's a great show, and I respect your guest. He's very knowledgeable. But as spending a lot of time in the state of Wisconsin, you have a lot of callers that call in and say how Governor Walker has ruined the state, and some people equate him to as the devil or the worst governor in country's history, in our state's history. He did win two elections, and he's the only sitting governor in our country's history, not in our state's history, but in our country's history, to survive a recall election. So there is a percentage of people in the state of Wisconsin that do like Governor Walker and do like some of the moves that he has made. And for him to run for president, he's giving up his governorship. And believe me, Rebecca Clayfish will not be our next governor. So for him to run for president, he is leaving it open. So the people that don't like Governor Walker, please get in line to run for governor, because we're going to have a new one in 2 years. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. I think he is very politically astute. He did win three elections in the state of Wisconsin, Keith, and he is now a serious candidate for president.
Yes, he is. He's definitely a threat. He's someone that the Democrats have been concerned about, no doubt, because of the fact that he was able to win three elections in a, what's considered a blue state. I think that whoever the Democratic nominee is would likely win the state of Wisconsin in the 2016 election, because you have a different electorate. And I think you'll turn out a larger percentage of people in urban areas and people who tend to vote for more progressive issues in the presidential election than you will in a state election for a governor or a recall election. Turnout makes a huge difference, and I think the fact that he won three times certainly makes him a formidable candidate, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he would win the presidency, and doesn't necessarily mean he would even win the state of Wisconsin if he were to win the nomination.
And is it a given, would you say, Keith, that the Democratic nominee will be Hillary Clinton?
I don't want to say that, but I feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders certainly has a following, and he has a strong message, and he could potentially be a very competitive challenger to Hillary Clinton. Whether he can translate that into electoral votes, I'm not sure. In part because Bernie Sanders represents a very homogenous, 95% white state. It's not reflective of the diversity of the current Democratic coalition. I don't know if he can win African-American voters. He voted against the Brady Bill when it came up 20 years ago, I guess it was. And so he's in a very comfortable position right now, because he's articulating progressive values that Democrats have been hankering for somebody to say for a long time now. I think that's part of the reason why President Obama's poll numbers are going up, too, because he's starting to do the same thing. But I think Hillary Clinton is the hands-down favorite, obviously, to win. So it would take Hillary Clinton's failure to lose, as opposed to Bernie Sanders' ability to win. I think,
yeah.
In other words, you know, it's hers to lose. Her race to lose.
And from Daniel on Facebook, we have about a minute and a half left. In my humble opinion, he says, the flag a person carries or burns does not make the revolution. It's in the heart and mind of the man. To many, the South Carolina Confederate flag commemorates the loss of relatives, a result of a war in which Lincoln said both sides pray to the same God. I feel, Daniel says, the same way about guns. They're harmless until they get into the hands of an unbalanced or uneducated individual. It's up to responsible citizens to try and teach love, tolerance, and respect, hopefully with flags and guns left out of the equation.
I'm not sure how to respond to that, but I support gun control measures. I don't think that every state should, every city, every jurisdiction, every county should have the same laws, I guess, but I do think that living in New York City, where I am, I don't like the idea of living in an apartment building where people in my apartment have access to guns, and just doesn't seem to be a very safe environment. But on the other hand, I understand people like Bernie Sanders and others come from different, more rural environments where people think differently. And I grew up around guns myself, so I understand that. But, you know, at the end of the day, people are entitled to have their own opinions, and Democratic Party, like other parties, is going to try to represent the views of the people who are going to vote for them. And so I think I'm against the Confederate flag. I don't think it's helpful for our country. And I'm in favor of reasonable gun control measures.
Well, Keith, thank you very much for being with us. You're utterly charming and very smart. So what more could a person ask for a political guest, huh?
Well, thank you, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to be a part of your show.
Thank you. Thanks for being with us. Keith Boykin, our guest. He is a New York Times bestselling author. He's a TV commentator, an actor, an educator. He's written 4 books. He was served in the White House as special assistant to President Bill Clinton. He is a CNBC contributor, MSNBC as well, and BET columnist. And we thank him very much for being with us. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up, and we'll talk about taking your vacation, hour 2.